Well, as you heard in the news, the UN General Assembly held a vote to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine 1 year on. That motion was carried 141 votes to 7 with 32 abstentions, because tomorrow marks the first anniversary of that invasion. Over 7,000 civilians are estimated to have been killed in that time, another 14,000 wounded, millions have fled Ukraine, 75,000 to Ireland alone, and today the Dáil marked the anniversary with a minute's silence. And then there was a far from silent exchange between People for Profits' Richard Boyd Barrett and the Taoiseach. Here's Deputy Boyd Barrett.
As the Taoiseach of a neutral country, formerly its Taoiseach, you say now is the time to reconsider the triple lock, to review essentially our position of neutrality and deploy 30 troops to participate in the war in Ukraine, in flagrant breach of our neutral status. Just as, of course, when you were in government back in 2003, you facilitated a million US troops to go through Shannon Airport in order to prosecute another bloody war. Don't you think, 1 year into the war in Ukraine, the lesson is a neutral country should be using its voice on the international stage to call for peace, negotiations, and to stop the terrifying escalation of this conflict that we are witnessing, which could bring the world to the brink of conflict.
Right, that was Richard Boyd Barrett and the Ciarán Corley in the background saying the time is up. Micheál Martin, the Taoiseach, responded.
Like the Ukrainians have a right to self-defence under the UN Charter. And if we can help with our up to 30, that's all, Deputy. To deal with demining, training. To deal with, and it's only training on European soil, to help them to deal with medical situations within Ukraine itself. We know from cluster munitions, which Russia has used, the extraordinary damage that can do after an attack, when children go out to play and get amputated because they pick up something that doesn't look like a bomb but is a bomb. And you're saying we shouldn't help to train people to prevent that terrible impact on civilians?
And that was the Taoiseach referring to, amongst other things, the decision to deploy 30 Irish troops as part of an EU training mission to Poland to train Ukrainian troops. Gráinne, it really took off. Metaphorically nuclear, it nearly went itself.
Yeah, it's not often that anyone is more outraged than Richard Boyd Barrett, but Micheál Martin got very angry at the suggestion that Ireland providing 30 troops to train, as he said there in the clip, train Ukrainian soldiers to disarm bombs, to medical combat is also included, so to treat wounded people in a kind of a warfare situation, that was in breach. Richard Boyd Barrett argued that was in breach of neutrality, and Micheál Martin is saying no, this completely comes under Ireland's offering of non-lethal support in support of Ukraine defending its own sovereignty, its own territory. But they've had this debate on and off a couple of times, but I think it kind of resonated a bit more now on the anniversary of the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because it kind of raises the question, well, what is the long-term strategy? Putin thought this was a 10-day war, that Kyiv would fall within 10 days, actually, I think. And that has not happened. It's gone on quite longer than I think even the EU expected. But what is the long-term strategy? Do you let the two sides keep killing each other, essentially, long-term, until they get so tired that then peace negotiations happen? Do you accede territory? That just seems completely immoral, considering the way the war started, with Russia completely invading Ukraine, ignoring international law, ignoring the structures of things like the Security Council, which are meant to fight combat. But what other alternative? Wars only seem to end after years when both sides get very tired. But it's the point that Richard Boyd Barrett kind of is making, that we are contributing to the prolonging of this, and surely there's a better way of doing it. The Taoiseach's argument is there isn't.
Okay. To the panel, Darren O'Rourke, the point about sending 30 Irish Defence Forces personnel to help train Ukrainian troops, and as we heard from the Taoiseach today, in demining, in battlefield paramedical help. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think it sits within the wider context of a growing conversation in relation to the nature of Irish neutrality. And I think, that conversation is happening, and, there's point from government towards different formats where that conversation might happen in a structured way. And I think that would be appropriate. And for our part, I think Sinn Féin will be clear in arguing the important role that we see for Ireland remaining non-aligned and a neutral state militarily. And also strategically, the importance of that neutrality and it, being advantageous to maintain it from a strategic point of view, but also from our role and I suppose the strength of our soft power rather than our military power. So I think the focus for us should be on the diplomatic effort, and we've seen that with our peacekeepers around the world. So I think when that conversation happens, and it does need to happen, but in the context of the proposal, now I'm not entirely sure what the exact details of the proposal are, but I would be I think it would have to be appropriately assessed. I think anybody that thinks of children happening upon a mine and not realizing it's a mine and suffering the consequences of that, that's something that you would want to support being addressed, but I'd need to see more of the detail in terms of what the exact proposal was, and be careful in terms of the potential door you're opening in relation to it.
All right, Mary Siri Kearney, the detail on this, we didn't know initially what these 30 troops were doing. We're hearing that it would be mine clearing. We've seen the Defence Forces in another context providing human rights training, mine clearing, but also urban warfare training in Mali. So do we know the detail? Do you know the detail of what the Defence Forces personnel will be doing in Poland?
To the best of my ability or the best of my knowledge, we will be providing counter-improvised explosive devices training, explosive ordnance disposal training, combat medical training and engineering training. So all of that is really important. We've got to remember that Ukraine is littered with mines that have been deliberately left there for the aftermath of the Russian withdrawal from particular areas that they have been left lethal for the population to go back into. So this is really very important. We're not going onto Ukrainian territory, or our military personnel aren't going onto Ukrainian territory. We are providing those training services that are essential to any sort of normal life. And I say that very reservedly because it's never going to be normal life, for a good number of years. So I think it is essential. It's essential that we do that. And I think the whole context of the war here.
But it's further than we've gone in any other act of conflict, isn't it? I mean, we are actively helping the armed forces of one side in a conflict on the European continent, and we are deploying those training resources to a neighbouring country. Now, you might be in favour of that, but isn't that a departure from missions we've engaged in heretofore?
I think that from the beginning of this war, we have very clearly separated our military, that we are militarily neutral all the way through, but that we are not politically neutral. The fact is that the Ukrainians, this is an unconscionable war. It is an appalling murder of the Ukrainian people. And we have been very clear on where we stood on that. We have co-sponsored UN resolutions. We have co-sponsored, we have supported humanitarian aid. We were first to come out with, 50 million in humanitarian and in the humanitarian and stabilization fund. That was our first contribution. So throughout, we have been.
But
very
are we
clear.
So outraged?
We
I suppose
we have taken a political side on this. There's no question about that.
But is this
party to the sanctions?
Is this halfway between a political and a military side?
No, I
this?
Don't agree with
okay.
that. I think
right,
this
Patrick
is a very
Costello,
humanitarian focused.
I think we need to stand up for international law. And that's one of the problems here is that international law is very weak and is ignored quite often by major states. And many countries are allowed to break international law with complete impunity, which undermines it. And is allowed to create an international situation where Vladimir Putin thinks he can invade another country and get away with it. So I think we need to stand up for international law. And that includes protecting countries, supporting them in their self-defense, supporting them in their right to resist occupation. I would like to see us do that, stand up for international law, not just in Ukraine and other places too. But certainly, I see what we are doing here as not crossing that line into military aid. I do see it still as non-lethal aid. I don't believe it's crossing a line. And I think that the world will ultimately be safer.
You're making that distinction on the specific training that's being provided. The fact that the Defence Forces personnel are going in there are not training Ukrainian personnel in an offensive capacity. But do you appreciate that if Ukrainian soldiers are mounting a spring offensive and have to clear minefields in order to advance on Russian lines, this could be used in an offensive capacity?
Well, it's also that the cluster munitions, which are banned, and again, they are banned under a convention that was signed here in Dublin.
Which Ukraine hasn't signed up to either.
If that convention is meant to have any reality or any teeth, we need to be doing things like this to put flesh onto the bones of international law and make it real, which will ultimately protect us and prevent the next war.
All right. On the fallout of the war, Darren O'Rourke, how are we doing with our integration and our care for the Ukrainian refugees that have come in?
I think it's a mixed bag at best. I think, you know, in my experience, the Irish people have been very welcoming and have, you know, opened their doors and their communities. There's a huge number of people. It is an unprecedented challenge, which, you know, is fair to recognise. But I'm sure as people listen to this, there'll be lots of people listening who said, you know, I've offered accommodation and it hasn't, you know, nobody came back to me. We have, you know, the knock-on effect in terms of people seeking international protection, you know, so the overall number of people seeking refuge here and our capacity to deal with them is really challenged, and I look at it in two terms: one, in terms of accommodation, and two, in terms of services. And there is, despite a year on, there is a huge scope for improvement in terms of.
On the accommodation front, what's the big lever government could pull on this in order to get speedy accommodation on track, or do you accept that there are major challenges here that can't be done quickly?
Well, there's a number of things, and it's not just Sinn Féin, it's many others, and including in the NGO sector, who point towards quick decisions, rapid response to those people who are offering accommodation, securing long-term commitments from providers. I know a number of those are back up, but using the existing state resources, state buildings, some of that involves, you know, adaptation and improvement works. But really, leaning on departments and the resources of the state in a way that they haven't done yet. And I appreciate that it's a significant challenge, but if you draw the comparison with COVID and the just coordinated, focused response that made things happen at pace and scale and in a systematic way, we haven't seen that. I know myself, even in terms of Gardaí, talking to local authorities, talking to IPAS, talking to private providers.
I don't think the effort is completely disjointed.
It's right. Disjointed.
Patrick Oslow, you were nodding along with some of that. I don't know whether it was in acknowledgement or agreement, but your party colleague, Roderick O'Gorman, has a lot on his plate, but says he can cope with it. The evidence would suggest otherwise.
I think he can cope with it. I think that at the very beginning, some mistakes were made. I think at the very beginning, we're talking last year, when the crisis kicked off and it was an emergency response, there was a lot of scrambling to get the emergency response up and going. I think at that stage, a lot of mistakes were made. And a lot of people, as Darren says, made those offers of accommodation and were never followed up on.
Mistakes were made by whom specifically?
I don't want to necessarily cast blame on any one person. I think there was a rushed response to try and deal with a very significant emerging situation. And the initial things that were set up perhaps were not as effective as they could have been. And the department very quickly made changes. It drafted in extra people. It changed the way it dealt with people. But I would point out, The start of the month, Roderick O'Gorman wrote to all his cabinet colleagues looking for those state buildings that Darren was saying, looking for buildings that were deemed safe, that could be turned around, already deemed safe, that could be turned around very quickly.
Was he left swinging in the wind?
Well, he was given about 500, is my understanding, a list of 500, two-thirds of which weren't actually suitable for accommodation right now. So there is the element that there is a lot of resources out there, perhaps for the state, but they're not suitable for accommodation. So I do believe the state and I do believe the department and I do believe the minister are working very hard on this. But we do need to
not suitable, or the political will's not there to make them fit for purpose? Because we saw with the Royal Hospital on Baggot Street that the community was on board with having it done up. By the assessment of at least one architect, the capacity is there to set it up. And the price tag that was put as a barrier there, 17 million, Mel Reynolds, the architect in question, said that that would be well worth paying as a price because of the hotel accommodation it would save on.
Well, I think also we should also be looking at, you know, we are all hoping this war will end and what can, and we should be thinking long term of using these, Baggot Street Hospital, for example, what can it be used for afterwards? And I do think that there is the political will there. I do believe the political will is there, and I do believe the minister is doing what he can to get this. All right. And he is working with others and he is getting support. But again, a lot of these buildings, like Baggot Street Hospital, they are very decrepit on the inside. They are not safe. They are not fit for hospitality. Okay. And that needs to be remembered.
Mary Siri Kearney, better than tents though, aren't they? And better than some of the other buildings we've seen people, and better than homelessness for people seeking international protection who are being handed a voucher and told we can do nothing for you.
I think that we have, I mean, if we look at the figures are extraordinary, that we have over 55,000 Ukrainians have been homed here, have been housed here as a direct intervention in the state. Over 75,000 have come in. The others, that difference have gone and stayed with friends that were already, or family that were already in Ireland. You know, we still have people coming on a weekly basis, and the staff and personnel in the, and we can only but pay tribute to them. Department officials in the Department of Children have been out and have worked through weekends, have worked 24-hour shifts to ensure welcome the supports for people in the likes of City West. So there has been an extraordinary effort all around, and in communities all around the country.
I suppose nobody would fault the effort, but the result, and when you look at the number of buildings that have been suggested that weren't taken up, or people talking about not being contacted when they offered buildings, you know, and the length of time it has taken to get back to people individually who have offered even rooms in houses, there is clearly a gap there in putting goodwill into action.
I think that we need to break that down into a few things. First of all, the offers of accommodation in people's homes, I think, yes, there was a slow response on that. I think people perhaps were initially on board and then became somewhat disillusioned, and there was some loss in that, but that was in the overwhelming surge of people coming at the beginning of this war, and I think that we shouldn't forget the context of it, of how extraordinary it was to see hundreds landing into Dublin Airport with just, you know, the bag that maybe they had down with them in the underground when they came out from that underground bunker to find that the apartment building they were in had exploded. You know, we had organisations in Dublin going over with coaches, bringing home children and their families with disabilities.
But the state of position of government was we would get 100,000 people this year. I mean, at the point of February, surely the time to start ramping up the resources to accommodate 100 people should have started then.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's definitely no lack of political will. And every department, I mean, we've had the OPW looking at, we're going to have rapid build homes. We're going to look at a lot of the buildings that are offered just aren't suitable. You know, if they don't have toileting, showering facilities, if they don't have the capacity to convert it, they won't get fire certs. If there are things like that, they're going to happen. We can't rush people into accommodation. It is better to have the resources there. And I think that we are putting in an extraordinary effort, and communities are putting wraparound supports all over the country in the most excellent way and being an Ireland of the welcomes.
I think it's a bit surprising that we've gotten a year in and there isn't a kind of a systematic way of when people come into the country, they go to the reception centre and then they are assessed for their needs and then they are sent to a community and there is a system where they are introduced to, you know, in a kind of a comprehensive way where the community is briefed on what is happening and you know, everything is known ahead of time. I think that we've gotten better at that. The country's gotten better at that as time has gone on, for sure. But the communications was not factored in at all at the start. And that has led to a distrust between community and government. On the pledging of accommodation, for example, part of the reason why that broke down seemed to be that they were just overwhelmed by the system. In fairness, nothing had been done like that to that scale before. It was done briefly, I think, after the outbreak of the Syrian civil war, but they were overwhelmed.
Yeah, not the same numbers.
But yeah. they then relaunched the pledging thing, outsourcing it to local authorities, and that seemed to have worked better the second time round.
Okay, Darren O'Rourke.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a measure of failure when we're, and I was listening to Morning Ireland this morning, and asylum seekers from Afghanistan living on the streets and talking about having their belongings stolen, their very limited belongings, and that's, you know, that's a measure of failure. And that we're only in a place a year on where there's, you know, an offer of potentially 500 buildings from within government. Like, why wasn't that 6 or 8 or 12 months ago? And also this idea that, well, they don't meet the standard. We've lots of people in accommodation that is substandard. But for me, it and the same in relation to rapid build units, it's almost as if there's a bureaucracy or a missing a can-do attitude to, like, find solutions where it mightn't be perfect, but it will be sufficient and certainly better than the street or a tent.
All right, Patrick, Costello, the other fallout, of course, has been energy prices, but, you know, it could be seen in some ways as an opportunity as well to get away from fossil fuel dependency and improve the supply of renewables. Is fossil fuel dependency now, in the light of 1 year on from this, for Europe and for Ireland, a national security as well as a climate security issue? And what can be done about it in terms of addressing the next year's needs? Because we're facing into another winter where energy costs could be huge.
It's always been a security thing, not just a climate security, but a national security issue. For as long as I've been talking about renewable energy, I've been talking about energy independence. And we have to move away from a reliance on oil and gas, which more than usually comes from authoritarian or despotic regimes. So Europe has stopped importing Putin's gas, but we're now importing gas from Azerbaijan, who have their own offensive record and horrendous record in terms of human rights, in terms of invading their neighbours, in terms of corruption. So energy independence, that sustainable energy, that renewable energy gives us, has always been a national security issue and has always been something certainly I've talked about when talking about the benefit of wind and solar.
But in order to transition towards that, would we be better off? And I know you appreciate what you're saying about Qatar and Azerbaijan, but they haven't invaded a neighbouring country.
Azerbaijan has.
Well, that is true. That is, they have invaded Armenia. But in regard to the storage of gas for the coming winter, is it not as well, before we have the infrastructure in place for renewables, is it not as well to have the storage in place for gas as we make that transition to renewables?
If we're building storage like an LNG, a massive LNG plant, you are anchoring yourself to coal, to gas. You're anchoring yourself to fossil fuels for a generation at least. And we just cannot do that because of the climate crisis coming down.
I know, but your colleagues in Germany, the Green colleagues in Germany, are prepared to accept burning coal as a compromise while they transition away from Russian gas. hard compromises are needed in a time of crisis, surely.
Well, we need to be ramping up our wind and our solar, because if we start building Shannon LNG, if we build Shannon LNG, it'll still be there in 25 years beyond this crisis.
Okay.
And eating right. into and Darn causing the next crisis, yeah. the climate crisis.
Yeah, I agree. There's huge considerations in terms of lock-in, but the other important point to make is the risk of blackouts and brownouts in Ireland isn't related to gas supply. Actually, I think we have one of the most secure gas supplies on the planet. I think the British system is over 150% supplied at peak demand. Our challenge here is turning that gas into electricity, its generation capacity. I think there was the Energy Security Review. It pointed towards gas storage onshore or offshore.
Do you think we need more storage?
Well, we don't have any, so we do, you know, we do need some, and we should build it. I think when you consider like the Energy Charter Treaty and the implications of that and this lock-in, you know, you build this stuff, you have to serve it for decades. I think we should look at state-owned, and I need to look at the numbers in relation to it, but state-owned gas storage that is readily transitioned to hydrogen in the future. That, for me, is my initial starting point in terms of what the right solution for Ireland.
All right, okay.